It's Thorax Lock.
Hey, you got your music.
Yeah. We'd like to welcome everyone to this episode of On Point. I'm your host, Don Allen, with co-host Ron Edwards. Hey, Mr. Edwards, how are you doing on this beautiful sunny day in Minneapolis, Minnesota?
Fine, Mr. Allen. It's almost like the first week of September. One should have a great appreciation, offered prayers for this kind of weather, if you will. The Minnesota Gophers just lost again. Oops. But how's it going, Don? What do we got?
Well, first of all, we're going to start out this morning. We have a lot of things to talk about today that are going on in the Twin Cities, but we're going to dabble with Fall Rivers to the Ramsey County Commissioner race. We have Mr. Andy Noble on the line with us. Mr. Noble, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing all right, Don. How you doing?
Okay, I'm doing great. Can you tell our listeners what's going on over there in Ramsey County with the Ramsey County Commissioner's race that you seem to be in, and you just want to do some things different over there? Just give us a brief synopsis of what's happening.
Absolutely, Don. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to come on your program and talk to your listeners. And we've got a lot of things going on over here in Ramsey County. This is a very, very special race. I'm probably running the only contested race of the four that are basically going on with the Ramsey County Commissioners. Mm-hmm. I'm running against Rafael Ortega, who's been in office for 16 years. And then we've got three of the other commissioners who are up for re-election, Tony Carter being one of the commissioners, and she's running against Rory Coe. And then the other two commissioners are actually running unopposed. We've got some really contentious issues, Don, in this race that we want to make sure that your listeners and others are very aware of. One of the main issues that has come up in this race is regarding commissioner conduct, and this is something that affects all seven Ramsey County commissioners. Back in 2008, all seven commissioners voted their own pay raise, as they are allowed to do, and voted a $21,000 pay raise on about a $61,000 salary, which is rather unprecedented for government. So this was a very big issue at the time. Certainly wasn't an election year, it was an election year, but we didn't have many of the commissioners up for re-election. And now, we're going back on this, and actually 14 weeks ago, they voted themselves yet another pay raise of 2% for 2011. So this is now an $84,048 a year part-time job with full benefits, retirement, and many, many different add-ons for this particular part-time position in government. And it's got a lot of people concerned.
Yeah, Mr. Noble, I was going to ask you, and you just confirmed it, that this is a part-time job at $84,000 a year. And go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Don, I mean, this is something that I think is often refuted by the commissioners, that they, in fact, do work full-time in this position. But, I mean, to give you an example, just Tuesday before last, they meet on Tuesdays at 9 a.m. typically. They have their executive council meeting. And the last executive council meeting lasted about 20 minutes. They do have other subcommittees and different committees that they serve on that are associated with the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, one of which is the Regional Rail Authority. So certainly they're spending some other time, you know, outside of an executive committee meeting, which is the kind of the weekly main meeting. But, you know, when you're meeting for 20 minutes, it's kind of hard to convince the public that, this is a full-time position. And I think my opponent, Rafael Ortega, just shared with the Pioneer Press a little over a week ago when we went in to talk with them that he was out at two elementary schools on the east side of St. Paul talking to second graders about what Ramsey County commissioners do. So I kind of think that there are much more pressing issues and needs for our commissioners and our leaders in government to be spending their time rather than talking just to second graders and spending 20 minutes at an executive meeting and making $84,000 a year to do that.
Mr. Noble, Ron Edwards, just a couple questions to get a clear picture of the structure of Ramsey County's board, but more importantly, Ramsey County's administration. What is the budget that the commissioners preside over?
Ron, excellent question. The annual budget for next year, fiscal 2011, will be $590 million.
Okay.
They oversee 4,000 county employees, $590 million budget. That's a $17 million increase from fiscal year 2010.
Now, if elected to the county board, if you should in fact be able to upset a four-term incumbent, would it be your intent to attempt to repeal some of those pay raises that the county commissioners have given themselves over the last 4 or 5 years?
Absolutely, Ron. As a matter of fact, two of my core platforms that would be the first resolutions that I would pass on the commission would be to cap commissioner pay and increases, that would also have the caveat that commissioners can no longer vote on their pay raises. That should be handled by an outside independent board or individual within government. I just think it's very conflictual to have anybody in government voting their own pay raises and their own performance associated. The second thing that I would do is I would put a cap on county property taxes for 2 years. I feel like Ramsey County, like all governments, should live, as property taxes are a significant source of revenue, they should live within the means of the times that we're in. And this is a big problem in Ramsey County, as well as Hennepin County and other counties, is government that is relying on property taxes in a declining real estate market, Ron, are continually putting more and more of this burden on businesses and homeowners, and it's why we see so many vacancies and foreclosures in our county, which also doesn't help the problem because those properties basically come off the tax rolls, and you see the kind of vicious circle that we end up with in a down economy is we're not really generating the revenues that we need in the first place by putting an increased burden on taxes on the folks that own homes and the people that own businesses.
All right. Give us a little idea of the configuration of the commission district, county commission district that you would be representing that currently is being represented by Mr. Ortega.
Yes. Our district is District 5, which is all of downtown St. Paul, the west side, which is predominantly the Hispanic and Latino communities, the Near East side, which is the Hmong community primarily, and then Highland Park and everything in between Highland Park and downtown on Shepherd Road and West 7th Street. That's predominantly our district. And then we actually take in Railroad Island, which is a little northeast of downtown. We probably have about somewhere underneath 40,000 households in that district. We've come up with about 23,000 door addresses in the district. So it's a very, very diverse cultural district of different ethnic populations.
All right. Mr. Allen, go ahead. You got anything?
Well, I don't have anything else. Is there anything did you like to tell our listeners, Mr. Noble, before you depart and probably do some door knocking today or some lit drops?
Absolutely. That's what we're out doing right now in Highland Park. I would basically just say that I'm a candidate running on fiscal conservatism. We have very important needs within the county and the social service structure. There's no question. My opponent and many of the commissioners, I think, suffer, gentlemen, from an identity crisis with this Board of Commissioners in that what exactly is the job description of a county commissioner? And I've addressed this publicly with the commissioners in several venues, and you literally will get a different answer from each of the commissioners as to what they say their priorities are, what their job description is. I think we have to bring that together as a community and decide what is the job of a county commissioner. I feel like a county commissioner needs to be very involved in economic development and creating jobs that are replacing jobs and population that has declined in Ramsey County the last 10 years so that we have a stronger tax base to pay these costs and to pay for these services aside from the taxes that we generate, because we can't keep burdening the tax base and creating more and more foreclosures and economic blight in the process, or we're just going to end up having a negative cycle, downward cycle that we're not going to be able to get out of.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Before I let you go, I also like to let our listeners know that based on fair practices here on the show On Point, we also did invite Mr. Commissioner Rafael Ortega to come to the show and did not get any response by the time of broadcast today. So, Mr. Noble, we thank you. Mr. Noble, Andy Noble is running for Ramsey County Commissioner. That's in St. Paul, covering the downtown districts in West St. Paul. We appreciate you calling in today.
Thank you, Mr. Noble.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate the opportunity.
Right.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Interesting observation, Mr. Allen, as it pertains to, Hennepin County, which is physically larger than Ramsey County, has seven commissioners. My recollection was many years ago that the legislature had initially said that Ramsey County really should consist of five commissioners. If you ever take a look at a map and you take a look at seven districts, you kind of wonder what kind of squeezing is going on. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah.
And I asked Mr. Noble specifically to identify the Commission District 5 that he was in, because I have this recollection many years ago of a debate, like I said, in the legislature with respect to the fact that, based on how they were structured, their physical size and et cetera, Ramsey County should probably only have 5 commission districts. 7 is really a stretch, got to tell you.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's good money.
That is. Good money, you can make it.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Edwards, I just, you know, like to let people know real quick, we were the moderators and hosts for the 2010 Minnesota 5th Congressional District debate here on Tuesday of this week.
Yes, sir.
And we had 3 of the independent candidates, if you will, come and join us. The Republican-endorsed GOP candidate or GOP-endorsed candidate, Joel Demos, did not show up. And neither did Congressman Keith Ellison, who is the incumbent, DFL incumbent. But, you know, on Thursday night, I happened to go to Bobby and Steve's. And for our national and international listeners, that's a local gas station franchise here with a big superstore with a little restaurant in it. And lo and behold, I see Congressman Keith Ellison standing outside on his cell phone. And so I whipped out my little camera, and he seemed kind of busy and didn't want to be disturbed. And when I walked a certain direction, his back was turned to me the whole time. But it's kind of funny that he did not show up. But we have a caller here, Mr. Edwards. Let's see what's on their mind real quick before we go into stuff.
Okay.
Hello. Hello, you're live on the air. Okay, that must be a pocket dial. Anyway, we had a really good time at the 5th Congressional Debate on Minneapolis Television Network, which is Channel 17, and they're going to start re-airing that episode here in the very near future, actually this coming week. So
That's excellent. I thought that the 3 candidates that did commit themselves and present themselves and debate the issues, I thought that they represented some significant depth. I was greatly disappointed, by the way, when we started talking about the issue of international affairs, particularly in light of a worldwide alert, the president committing himself to a drawdown, but the tension between the Islamic world and the Christian world, quote-unquote, and the tensions here in the United States, and in that, you know, Congressman Ellison is one of only 2 Islamic or Muslims in the Congress of the United States, he being the first, according to the record, I was greatly disappointed because I thought it was so important for us to have the wisdom and depth and the knowledge. I mean, clearly this is a congressman that has traveled extensively, quite a bit, to the Middle East, particularly to Saudi Arabia, if you will, has enjoyed the hospitality of the Royal Saudi House and et cetera. And I just thought that he would, with those many trips that he has made, I assume they're fact-finding, that he could have added a certain depth, if you will, particularly when we got into the question of rendition, the official American policy of retaining holding and torturing suspects, as was pointed out by one of the panelists, first introduced under the Clinton administration and really intensified under the Bush administration and unfortunately continued under the Obama administration. But for whatever reason, the incumbent congressman was not able to or chose not to, to be present.
Yes, and we have a variety of things today to talk about, and I think we need to start with currently what's going on with the Minneapolis Public Schools. And,
yes.
Yeah, and what's happening there, and with in particularly North High School.
We are informed here at On Point that on tomorrow, in tomorrow's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, there will be a story which will report the closing of North High School. And it will apparently take place, I assume, that they will allow the academic year to continue until June of next year, but I'm really not quite sure, Mr. Allen. But the Star Tribune will break the story, and the story may very well indicate that on the 19th of this month, October, Superintendent Bernadier Johnson will formally ask the board for a final authorization to allow for the closing of North High School and also the raising of the building. Certainly a lot of it has to do with enrollment. The enrollment has declined to the place that, and that you never can get the truth from the district. Some are saying the enrollment now is as low as 260, 270 students. But there's also an environmental health issue at North, Don, that has been present for quite some time. The district has known about it. Health officials have known about it. And it has to do with significant contamination inside of North High School. And it had to do with the fact that that during the construction of that school, with all the money, taxpayers' money, that went into the building of North High School, that the pipes were never wrapped. And over a period of time, pipes not being wrapped, as anyone knows, I'm talking about all forms of pipes, brings about a serious threat and jeopardy as it pertains to environmental conditions, environmental health, pollution, toxicity, and et cetera. And that is another undercurrent that the district will move very quickly to raise that building, to take that building down. But the Star Tribune allegedly will report on tomorrow that North High School is slated to be closed down at the end of the school year.
Wow. And you know what? I was just kind of – this seems to me like there is some planning here with some behind-the-scenes folks that are in our community that represent themselves as spokespersons. And I understand there was a special delegation, Mr. Edwards, sent to Chicago to look at one of the super charter schools that use psychotropic drugs to control and modify child behavior. And I also understand that Mr. Al McFarland, publisher of the Insight News, was a participant in this. But we haven't heard of Pete anywhere in the media or in his media about this, which will lead me to something else in a second.
Well, it is absolutely correct, Mr. Allen. You are absolutely correct. A delegation of maybe as many as nine, the district sent at least four Caucasian members of their staff and administration to Chicago. Apparently, Eric Mahmoud of Seed Academy was so distraught with respect to what he saw that according to one of the individuals that was also in attendance, not Mr. McFarland, that Eric Mahmoud went off, if you will. Some maintain that the special super mega charter school in Chicago is nothing but excuse the use of the word, a rendition of a modern concentration camp. The word is that they are looking at Lincoln as a site for the mega school, and that makes sense with the additional report indicates also what appears to be the demise of the Minneapolis Urban League.
Yes.
It appears that a date certain has been set for that, and that would continue to enhance what has been in play ever since Dr. Cecchetti was brought here from Rochester, New York, to begin his experimental medicine projects, that the plan by the University of Minnesota is to create a significant urban campus in the Pacific area that is now identified as UROC, the Urban League, North Point, those Pacific areas. And it makes a lot of sense to take North, dismantle it, create a new version of urban education and experimental education and experimental medicine at a place like Lincoln as a part of the overall experiment. And I would call people to the many papers, clinical papers, that Dr. Cecchetti wrote while he was at Mount Hope in Rochester, New York. Your comments just minutes ago are absolutely on point, if you will. This is a sad occasion, but it appears both North and ultimately the Urban League of Minneapolis, as we first reported in our column back in August 5th, actually, of last year. The title was Minneapolis Urban League on Shaky Ground, as well as we reported, and I just feel so distraught, Mr. Allen, first reported the dismantling of North High School in June of 2008. People said that all of us guys were making that up.
Yeah. You know, Mr. Edwards, we have Mr. Lenny Chisholm from Springboard on the line, but I want him to hold for a minute. Just don't hang up, Mr. Chisholm, because I need to, you know, Mr. Edwards, you're the expert here. You're the guru, and I'm Don, so you're the expert here. But we have an issue with news and information distribution to our community from a major news network in North Minneapolis called Insight News, because if you remember, Mr. Edwards, on Monday, September 27th, okay, Monday, September 27th, a story titled Urban League Suspends Operation of Residential Group Home was published and distributed in the Insight News.
Absolutely.
The reason for this, quote, directly related to the lack of referrals from Hennepin County.
Mm-hmm.
On this Thursday, the 7th of October, at the YWCA or North Commons, there was a meeting held with Hennepin County representatives. And I don't even have to say anything, but they disputed this, and I have it on video. If you go to IBNNnews.com, the Hennepin County representative says, well, they're thinking about changing ownership of the group home. That's why they were not concerned with getting the beds filled in the group home, and that's why they suspended operations, not because Hennepin County wouldn't send them any bodies to put in the beds. So,
and you're absolutely correct. Both of us were – I was sitting right there as that statement was being made, and you were recording that. And there was no refutation in that room about that, other than Mr. Alfred Flowers indicated there had been a misquote. But we now find out that there was some questionable journalism that took place in the form of statements being crafted that actually were not made by representatives of the county, and that's a dangerous precedent.
Yeah, it is. We got Mr. Chisholm. Are you still there?
Yes, Mr. Al.
Yes.
I'm still hanging on here.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chisholm. Welcome. Go ahead, Mr. Al.
Go ahead. Mr. Chisholm, I had a statement. We've been kind of having a – I released some of this information on Facebook and on my blog about an hour before the show, and it seems to have started a little whirlwind of conversations back and forth. And Ms. Chisholm, go ahead. Your comments, please.
Well, you know, mine is related to the Urban League and also what I consider they failed to reach the community, and they've been doing that for a number of years. And so thus, when people say, well, we want to have the Urban League speak for us as spokespersons and so on and so on, I ask, I say, well, are they really in touch with the community anymore? When they recruited the new executive director into the community, one of the basic questions I asked, I said, are you going to live within the community or just, you know, pick up a paycheck? And the other person that was with him answered prior to him, and he saw the reaction, because often you can't see reaction when you're speaking as well. But he read the feelings in the room that's not the answer that people wanted to hear, was that I'm not going to live in the community. I want to live where I want to. And so now we're hearing problems with funding, because the real issue is, who are they really serving in the community, and what actions are they actually trying to accomplish? And at the end of the day, is anyone willing to believe and join them in their whatever struggles that they're supposedly fighting for? So that's what I think is what's really coming out, and it's happening around the country. When the federal programs stopped filling the coffers, suddenly they were no longer able to keep open their doors. Maybe the federal government knew that their programs aren't necessarily reaching the community. So I mean, that's what, you know, my position is that they just have lost touch, as many programs from the past have. What do you guys think?
Well, first of all, we collectively as a blog team were breaking this story a year ago and a little bit longer, as I said, in the newspaper column that I write for the Spokesman Recorder. Talked in terms of the Urban League being on shaky ground, and also in that particular column pointed out that the St. Paul Urban League had tragically gone under and, in fact, out of business. The Spokesman Recorder later on assigned a reporter, Vicki Nash, to write a two-part series, and again, in a manner which certainly created distress and drought and everything else, the United Way reported that the St. Paul Urban League had been on probation for 6 years. And I'm afraid that you're going to find the same thing as it pertains to Minneapolis, that they were placed on administrative probation because they failed to meet goals and obligations commensurate with receiving even the public monies, if you will, that come through the United Way and other organizations. You're absolutely on point. I know that there is great concern at this particular hour that the financial status of the Minneapolis Urban League is just a nightmare, and I'm just not sure that they will have their doors open by the end of this year.
Okay. Mr. Chisholm, Mr. Edwards? Okay.
Yes, sir.
I think Mr. Chisholm is gone here, but this is just what, remember about three episodes ago when we had an exclusive interview with Ms. Star Parker?
Yes,
yes. About the National, about the Urban League? This is hitting home to exactly what Ms. Parker was saying.
Yes.
In word for word. And it's very interesting. If Mr. Chisholm would like to call back, that'd be glad, because we'd be glad to have him, because almost a year ago today also, I launched a Facebook campaign, Don Allen for Minneapolis Urban League president. And Mr. Chisholm will be back with us in a minute here. And so I was doing that because once I did that, Mr. Edwards, I had like 500 people from around the country as fans of that particular movement. I got a call from three local foundations and said that, hey, Mr. Allen, if you get in there, we have your back.
Okay.
And it was really unusual because I had former Women's Venture Executive Director Tanae Wells catch this information from these foundations. And she actually gave me a call and says, you know what, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be talking to funders for your platform on this. And I says, well, wait a minute. Now, this was unsolicited phone calls. I'm not calling anybody up begging them for a dime. These are people that are sick of the current infrastructure over there at the Minneapolis Urban League and said they want to change and they need a bulldog, basically, you know. And so, you know, that conversation I had with Mr. Nate Wells was I just had to let it go and not get angry at her for calling me. But, you know, then again, she gets hired at the Minneapolis Urban League to work and has a couple of boxing matches, and then she's no longer there.
I was going to ask the question, is Nene Wells still there? Because I know I haven't heard her voice or any recitals by her in quite some time. And so apparently that was an appointment for the purposes of propaganda or what?
Yeah, I feel, you know, that's exactly what it was there. Because, you know, Mr. Edwards, I met with Mr. Scott Gray. And I met with Mr. Scott Gray to say that, okay, I've been writing about you for a year. I attempted to develop a campaign to overthrow you. I says, nothing seems to be working. I says, maybe that we can put our two heads together collectively. So I went over there as a good guy, extending an olive branch or whatever to him to say that, well, maybe with my talents and your talents and our networks combined, we can actually do something. Because I told him, I says, you don't know the players in town. The people that brought you to Minneapolis, Alfred Babington Johnson from the Stair Step Foundation, and Al McFarland and some of the other board members have thrown you under the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have a clue about who the players in the town is. And another thing, you know, you could probably fool a lot of Minnesota, a lot of Minneapolis, because, Mr. Edwards, if we look at it, you know, Bernie Madoff, who made off with all these folks' money,
billion.
He got the largest amount of money from the state of Minnesota.
Yes, he did.
Yes, and so I'm saying you can only fool some of the people some of the time, okay? And if people aren't comfortable with you, if you're not playing in your realm of expertise, you're not going to survive here. And since you're going to need some help with people that aren't traditionally at the table, people that you don't traditionally get along with. And I just like to let people know also you can call in at 1-877-572-4288. That's our toll-free call-in number is 1-877-572-4288. And we're broadcasting live in downtown Minneapolis for the McIntosh Studios. Mr. Edwards.
Yes, sir. Did Mr. Chisholm get back to us?
Yeah, he's right here. And I'm glad he's here, you know, Mr. Edwards, because I have that 2-minute piece from Star Parker a while ago.
Let's play it. Let's do it.
You have to listen to it. Mr. Chisholm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to play this real quick because this is a very good piece here. Star Parker, a little background before I hit go here, is running for Congress out in California, actually Compton area. And she broke down to a in this interview that was actually, I had a service to actually call her and interview her on behalf of On Point, and this is the interview.
There were, when we were talking about the African American, the black community and black leaders, one of those organizations that frankly we struggle with here in my area and areas around the country is the Urban League. They seem to have meshed with a lot of course, the black pastors we're talking about and the so-called black leaders in the community to have that liberal coalition that makes it, you're right, political, social suicide to go up against them. Recently you had some comments about the Urban League, and I wanted to see kind of how those were playing out and what you were hearing about them.
Well, what we know is that there is an agenda of a secular state of mentality. You know, I describe it basically as the cultural war being two sides vying for space. You have a biblical worldview that was set in our rule of law as a nation. But you, on the other side, you have a secular worldview that doesn't like the fact that God said, here are the boundaries, here are the rules, and that our founders thought that they were important enough to thread them through our Declaration and into our Constitution so that the role of government is limited to protecting our interests, to protecting us from our neighbor's sin. The rest of it is up to us. To live free, you have to be responsible. But there's a war against that, and so you have those that have this agenda to their core, the secular statist agenda. But then, think about the old slave plantation. There are 4 million slaves in the country, and they live in this plantation. And this, the owner, let's put him where that secular statist is. But you had overseers where their exclusive job was to keep those slaves in place. And that's where I would categorize the Urban League and many of the other civil rights organizations, as well as the People for the American Way and the ACLU and the all of the media. They're like the old plantation overseer. So that if anybody decides they're going to talk about freedom or anybody decides that they really want difference and change, that person is brought before the rest, kind of like what they used to do when somebody would run away up the underground. They catch them. They bring them back. They bring all the other slaves out to watch them strip the skin off of that slave's back and bruise them forever so nobody else would ever try to run away. That's where I put the Urban League. They have shaken down corporations in this country, multiple millions of dollars, and their exclusive job now is to keep poor people poor. They keep them on the plantation and to keep them in a victim mentality.
Your thoughts?
Mr. Allen, let me just say again for transparency, let us just indicate that the voice that they heard interviewing Ms. Jones is an associate of ours, a program out of Tampa, Florida, just so we're clear. And he was the host of that program. He was interviewing her, and he is in collaboration with us, and Mr. Allen was able to obtain access and her comments are very profound and very troubling.
Yeah, very troubling. Mr. Chisholm, you have any comments on that?
Well, I think she's entitled to make her statements, and whether she's correct, incorrect, or I'm okay with whatever statement she makes. I think one of the key components that I've seen around the country from the Urban League that I've seen, I think she's on point with saying a lot of money has come into the Urban League and the end results have not necessarily said that they've spent the money in ways that would generate economies for the poor communities for which they're there to represent. Some of the best social things can occur when people have jobs. And so if we look at the situation of our Urban League, they've had a vacant lot on one corner and Mr. Edwards, you probably can speak to this more so than I can, a vacant lot on one corner for 35-plus years and a vacant lot across the street for over 20-plus years. So if you have people in a community that aren't aware that the community, of all the needs that it has, is it needs money. It needs to have minds in a community that brings money in. And thus, the Urban League can try to solve all the social ills that it wants based on government funding. But at the end of the day, we need to have a group of people inside of that organization that focus on creating wealth within the poorest community in the state. The numbers just came out. We're the second worst out of 50 states, 50 major metropolitan cities that for contractors. Well, the Urban League says we're a champion for contractor development. They have programs that have been going over there for 20 years. Mr. Edwards, you can speak to these things. Mm-hmm. So when they come to the table and people say, well, should they go? And I go, well, I'm similar to Ms. Parker. Well, if they keep staying around, will we ever get a chance to get other ideas to come to the table? That is the real issue here. Is if they're stifling ideas, then of course they got to go, as anybody would. CEOs come and go every day. How many CEOs get fired and the stock go up?
Absolutely.
I mean, what do you guys think about some of that?
Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Harris.
Oh, I think that Ms. Chisholm's absolutely correct. There's a long history. Maybe one of these days here on Point, we will you will have me spend probably about a half hour going over the history leading up to the coup of 1989 when yours truly was forced out as chairman of the board, and the entire board was forced out because of our aggressive posture. And we left a very positive legacy. We left property. We left significant assets, and et cetera. And over the last decade, I've watched all of that evaporate, if you will. But there is an interesting story to be told with respect to the kind of opposition, the conspiracy that took place in 1988-89 against the league, who some of the players were. Some are now deceased. Some aren't, if you will. And it was kind of foretold that what was getting ready to happen would have an ill effect on the broader African American community. It's taken.
We have a caller here.
Oh, go right ahead. We want to hear that. Let's get him.
Go ahead, caller. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Lewis. I'm calling from Woodbury, Minnesota. How are you today?
I'm doing great, sir. How are you? Your comment.
Great. I was calling about the discussion about North High.
Okay, well, we can jump back. We've developed a coup here on Point, and we can have that conversation. Your question, sir.
Well, I find it hard to believe that no one saw this coming, given the fact that it's a school with a capacity of 1,800 kids, and since Mike Faber left, we saw it drop down to around 600. They even tried to bring in that middle school program, which was an that came out of one of their little junior highs. It was an utter disaster, and they brought in a principal who subsequently now I believe is an AP at a middle school, which tells her skill level. But a couple things happened here that I don't understand why people go, well, how can we save North? A, totally inept leadership, and people voted with their feet. And then B, with the decline of the housing stock and folks losing their homes, even rental properties and or houses because of foreclosure, this was a lot of pressure. So I don't really see how it's possible for folks to stand up now and say, save the school. I think this has been overcome by events. I just want to know, do you think any differently than that?
Well, Mr. Allen, let me certainly answer that for Lewis out in Woodbury, if you will. First of all, there were people who called attention to this and called attention to it even before the actual planning went. And I would refer you, sir, I know you have your computer there with you, in the June 11th, 2008 edition of the Minneapolis the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, this co-host wrote a story and a notification to the community that North was slated to be closed down. 7-8 days prior to that, Lewis, in a meeting with Bill Green, superintendent at that time, in the boardroom of the Minneapolis Urban League, dealing with matters pertaining to a entity that ultimately was going to be created called the Covenant, I personally asked Superintendent Green, was it a fact that North was slated to be closed down, and that the target date was anywhere from 1 to no more than 2 years. Bill Green, in the presence of, and I remember that day, I counted the room. I always like to do that. There were about 37 individuals in that room. Many of them know who they were. Bill Green said it would never happen, not on his watch or in any other time. There was no plans afoot, et cetera, et cetera. I knew that not to be true. And you may want to go back and take a look at my column again in the June 11th edition, 2008 of Minneapolis Spokesman Recorder. In fact, I took a lot of heat for raising that issue and raising subsequent some additional issues and wrote about it again. And I was fascinated at the kinds of attacks that were leveled against me as a columnist and community person, or even suggesting that this blasphemy was a possibility. I think you, I, and others all know that this has been at play for quite some time. You're quite correct. We really haven't gone into the kind of detail we need with respect to the whole Dunwoody proposition, if you will, how that took place, how that played out, and, in fact, that Dunwoody bailed out at the end of the last school year. The individuals who were on Dunwoody's so-called community board, our good friend, Ezell Jones, as an example, was one of those who was promoting the fact that Dunwoody was the savior for not only North but for public education in the city of Minneapolis. I'd like to hear from Ezell. I'd like to have Ezell and some others who were a part of that entire process to explain to us what the heck happened. You're absolutely right. In fact, 10 weeks ago here on Point, we, Mr. Allen and myself, reported in a discussion similar to this, that we were just taken back by the fact that the incoming freshman class at North this year was 65, which was a clear indication, Lewis, that if you got 65 students coming in, that you're not going to survive. There will not be a senior graduating class. And again, we called out to community to take note, if you will. And so I agree with you. I concur that there
I do want to ask you this. What does that say about the faith that the community has in North High as a school? What does that say about it? I think the people are speaking, and we should not overlook their voice in this case.
Oh, I certainly agree. But at the same time, the community has a tendency to expect that people who maintain that they are, quote-unquote, leaders and spokespersons and thought leaders and all that are creative enough and that there was some kind of plan to foot. But let me repeat for you again what I said happened in the meeting in the last week of May 2008 when the superintendent of schools, an African-American, a professor at the University or at Augsburg College, a man of impeccable credentials, according to the book, when asked specifically by a member of community if the plan was afoot, he said it was not. He said it was something that was far-fetched. African-American was incorrect in his question and the crafting of his question. So what happens, Lewis, the community begins to reach a point where they become confused because they cannot believe, number one, that people with the kind of credentials of former Superintendent Green would lie and misrepresent a situation. And they begin then to question the fact that advocates who step forward to the plate are providing factual information with respect to the circumstances that are in existence. And so people have enough to do in our community, as I think you know, Lewis, to survive.
It's a full-time job.
Yeah, spend time trying to figure out at what point of the convolution, if you will, of this so-called leadership battle is really all about. And I think it's really sad, but I think it's real tragic to see what is happening with North, but your point is well taken.
One final question for the community. Do you think that this, in a way, in an obtuse kind of sick way, could be used as a way to get leverage with the administration? Because if the people aren't showing up, they're sending their kids to other places, they're moving out of the district, then that weakens the teachers' union. It takes away the leverage, and those are the people who are in the room. There's no accountability in the district. I heard someone on NPR yesterday saying that, well, in the teaching profession, they've not found a good way to evaluate teachers or to ensure that they're delivering instruction. So I view this as the public has spoken. It's unfortunate, but at some point this gets down to whether or not people believe their kids could get a good education in that school. And either they left that school or they didn't come into this community. So how do you think this will impact the position with the teachers union?
Well, first of all, you're talking, again, to a journalist and a columnist who 7 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, in my column again in the Spokesman Recorder, and Mr. Allen and myself entertained discussion on that. I called for the school district to be placed in receivership, all right? And there are constitutional provisions that allow that to happen. You know yourself. You have been in the sensitive position of knowing what happens in a battle with the teachers union, the power of the teachers union, particularly in a state like Minnesota, which is labor-oriented, if you will, labor union-oriented. The union is going to fight you into hell before they agree to some of the recommendations and suggestions that are being made. I think, though, that the line has been drawn in the sand when you talk in terms of the number of functionally literates that are being produced within the public school systems of America, and particularly this state. At some point, a decision is going to have to be made to draw the battle lines. Is the community up to it, Lewis? I don't know. They'll have to answer that question.
Well, it seems in the case of North High, they've spoken.
Well, you know, I'm going to chime in a little bit here. One of the things, and I've been to a couple of those meetings, various sources. One of the questions I asked, has anyone done any data analysis to determine how many generations of kids remain in North High, in the community around North High after graduation?
Mm-hmm.
And if we could take that information to try to look at possible solutions to help maintain the people who grew up in the community, you're always going to get a percentage that will leave, but if you're getting over 70, 80, 90% leaving every year. If you got 65 freshman class.
Yeah, 65 with the incoming class. Mm-hmm.
And if all 65 leave, then you have no one willing to stay in the community. There's other factors. The concept of community is built upon generation after generation after generation somehow willing to stay in and make it work. But North High doesn't have repeat generations. You may go in there and get maybe one or two kids, we've had three generations of kids in.
Absolutely.
So that's one of the factors. So then you look around all the factors in North High. When North High was originally came about, look at all the things that have disappeared. The walking community has pretty much evaporated for various reasons.
Okay.
The economy of the community has evaporated for various reasons. So every time someone gets a chance to leave, then everywhere they go seems like a better lifestyle than right there in North High. So to piggyback off of what Lewis said, I believe for sure it can be used as a leverage point to bring an economy, to bring a new community organizations, to change some of the old guard and say, hey, you guys have been run this as far as you can run it. I'm thinking that there is an opportunity to put some leverage for different investment strategies.
Yeah, I agree. Stand by. We have another caller. Go ahead. What's your name and where you're calling from?
Mustafa. I'm calling from Minneapolis.
Okay, and your name, sir?
Mustafa.
And your question?
Now, I have a question. My question is why do we have to depend other people to fund us and give us money? Why can't we get together as a community and do whatever we want to do? I think we have that power, but we don't realize, because if somebody gives you money, then you have to do whatever they tell you to do when it comes to civil rights, schools, everything.
Okay. Mr. Edwards, you think I can chime in on Mustafa's
go
question?
Go right ahead.
Mustafa, you said something that was very interesting. You said if someone gives you money, you have to do what they tell you to do, okay? In the community of North Minneapolis, you have amounts of $50,000, $103,770, $200,000 going out to people not for the betterment of the community, but for their personal benefit in their pockets. I can give you about 40 to 50 examples, including Stair Step Foundation with Alfred Babington Johnson that, within the last 10 years, and Lenny knows about this too, Mr. Chisholm knows about this, that got as much as $30 million to do the Dairy Queen, the Cieza, the frozen processing food plant, the Tires Plus, and that particular agency has gotten a lot of money to do this. But yet there's not a business in North Minneapolis that has 20 black people working for, or let's just put 20 people at all in the community working for it. And when we're to exclude McDonald's, the Kemp's plant that has been there since before the 60s, and the Cub Foods, which has been super valued, which has been around, you know, before I was born.
Target.
So the money that comes in the community, yeah, you know, the Minnesota Department of Transportation just gave the Minneapolis Urban League $150,000. The news that came out to us was that they were going to start this big highway heavy construction training program and get us black people or get them Negroes out there with shovels working on the highways and roads and bridges of Minnesota. Well, if you go press these people after the story on the Star Tribune, the story on the Minneapolis or Minnesota Public Radio, if you go right to the people at MnDOT and ask them, okay, you say, you know, I just look like this. I'm not a fool. I know that a training program is about $4 to $5, $6 million a year organization. How can the Urban League do this with $150,000? Okay. Then they come clean. Well, we want to pay off someone because he's retiring, and the other money is to hire a new person. So, again, the community, you know, you've given some money to someone. The PR has been spun or the message has been spun, and it's nothing. It's ineffective. So
I think what he's probably saying is that if they wrote a grant to get some money, the grant wasn't utilized in a way that many people would hope to have done. And so thus we ask the question, well, if they've been a failure multiple times, then why give them another opportunity?
Yeah.
The money came in the room, so why did we not give it to someone else? We've already proven that they were going to be failures repeatedly. So then you and Mr. Edwards, you know more about how this money has come into the community based on your knowledge and experience. We keep asking the question, how do we keep letting them sashay up to the table? You know, what do we got to do as a community to get them before the powers that giving the money away stop giving them the money?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's, you know, been discussions on that. There have been articles that have been written about that. Unfortunately, there's a history about that. But for whatever reason, as I said to Lewis, folks have so much, unfortunately, on their plate just to survive the kind of organizational structure that I hear the callers and yourself talking about is something that is not a possibility given the unfortunate conditions of the African-American community. I'd like to see it different, but I know for the facts of reality that it's not. But at the same time, something better happen pretty quick because we are in big trouble, yet we still have tremendous talent as the African-American community. We still have tremendous energy. We still have tremendous intellectual talent and et cetera. But as you said, when you talk in terms of no history of those that have, let's say, in the case of North, who have graduated and immediately flee the community. Now, we think that that's something akin to rural America. Okay, but nobody really talks in terms of that as a part of the urban problem. So, you know, again, an observation.
If Lewis is still on the line, I mean, maybe he can give some insights into some of that. He's been around for a while, too.
Well, I think that one of the things we got to really look at is what has happened to the will to invest in that community over the course of years. I thought I heard a discussion about some of the initiatives around Tires Plus and the Dairy Queen, that type of stuff. I would say that, wow, you know, you got to go to the – I don't knock anybody for taking, you know, a shot and taking risks, but it's like, wow, you know, how many times and how many times did we get left holding? And sooner or later, the stomach, not only the stomach for investing in the community the money dried up, and I think we see a very different – political will. For example, as much as I might have opposed Jackie Cherry Holmes when she was city council person, at least she provided competent leadership that brought money to the district. I mean, you can't doubt that. And, of course, in a mayor like Sharon Sells Belson, we had the will to support the community, but our chancellor was to, you know, do this whole ridiculous thing about guns rather than look at the economic side or say anything about that as well. I'm fixing the kids' bikes. But at any rate, so I think we've seen a tremendous change in the landscape. We've gotten away from mobilization, which says we want to be quiet because we're afraid that if we make any noise, we're not going to get anything when we're not getting anything anyway. And that right now things are very tight, so it gives people cover. And so we're seeing the results of that now. And I think what we got to do is just hold on and do what we know works. And it's not going to be easy, but as they used to say, we shall overcome.
Right. Okay.
Hey, well, look, I'm going to have to sign off. You guys, once again, pleasure to have an opportunity to talk with you, and I look forward to future times.
Okay. All right, then.
Well, hey, thank you, Mr. King. Thank you, Mr. Chisholm. And we're at the bottom of the hour. And
Don, give that telephone number again.
That phone number.
We have some people out there that have some other kinds of opinions. And we thank Yusuf for calling in.
Excuse me,
Masafa for calling in. Yep.
That call-in number is 1-877-572-4288. Again, the call-in number, the toll-free call-in number is 1-877-572-4288. Mr. Edwards, we have to keep rolling here because we have several organizations. We have the YMCA. We have North Memorial Hospital. The Star and Tribune's reporting on the recent homicides and incidents surrounding the homicides. And the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights. Kind of all in one big twin bed together here this week.
Well, Mr. Allen, we had another controversy as it pertains to life and death and the importance or the non-importance of the African-American. While we were broadcasting from Omaha last Saturday, as you remember, we happened to mention the fact that earlier that morning a very serious criminal act had taken place in an individual as a part of an act of rage as an outcome or outgrowth of a confrontation, had driven his car at probably speeds approaching 60 miles an hour or better into a crowd of at least 10 individuals, and that number specifically comes from an article the following Sunday, the following day in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. A gentleman by the name of Meeks was killed instantly, okay? A number of people were injured. But the story and on both television, radio, and newspaper indicated at least 10 people had been hit. Three had been hospitalized.
Yes.
Two males and one female. And on Monday, there was an additional kind of follow-up. Lo and behold, we looked up on Wednesday, Minneapolis Star Tribune reported that the second male had died.
Yeah.
But he died at his home.
And Mr. Edwards, I just want to interject here. Our switchboards are lighting up, and we just like our callers to hold on until Mr. Edwards lets us, fills us in on all the information.
And I will accelerate it very quickly. What happened was a gentleman by the name of Johnson, 42 years old, who everyone thought was a patient at North Memorial, had apparently been put out of the hospital as early as Sunday. Now, let me say quickly, and then we'll go to the call. We have been in contact with both the medical examiner, and we have had a series of discussions with the Star Tribune. In fact, we kind of worked on a couple pieces to get the information. I had sources independent of anybody else give me the name of the deceased by Thursday. I called Dr. Andrew Baker, the chief medical examiner for Hennepin County. It was a testy and curt conversation. He wasn't very happy with the fact that I was insisting that the name certainly needed to be made available. I was greatly disappointed this morning when I did not see any follow-up story on Mr. Johnson, and there was nothing in yesterday's paper. But by and large, what happened was that this man who had serious injuries, he had head injuries, he had broken bones, he had been drugged by the automobile on at least two separate occasions. It hit him and drug him. The guy came back, ran over him, drug him some more. So he had serious internal injuries. At best, Mr. Allen, in conclusion on this particular point, you had something approaching criminal negligence as it pertains to North Memorial. I have been fascinated by the role of the Star Tribune and the medical examiner in covering up North Memorial's role or lack of. Meanwhile, though, Mr. Johnson is deceased, having died in his home in excruciating pain.
Oh, no. That is not good at all. Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead, your question.
Hi. I have this is Mustafa again, calling from Minneapolis. I just tweeted you, you know. I always hear about the complaints about other people who are just making money and claiming that they helping the community. I know there are people like that all over, but why can't we as a people get together and depend on our service and not depend on money from other people and organize our people? You know, it's the same way that they give some money, African dictators, and then they take the money and transfer it to some account in Switzerland. So I don't see any difference. I think because they are the same people, they're using the same policies to, you know, oppress people, you know. And I think that's something that we need to come over one way or another.
Well, sir, I just, you know, and I'll answer your question. I'll just try to answer it. I just haven't seen a really hard push. For example, I've never seen a current professional athlete on one of the professional teams here in Minnesota, African-American, male or female, walk in the front door of the Urban League. Okay? I've never heard of a fundraiser where these types of people with discretionary funds that could donate $5,000 and it would be like you or I giving away $10, so it wouldn't hurt them, even being catered to do that. There's not a process set up. I understand the point about, you know, get, you know, the African-American community in the United States is, you know, a $630+ billion a year industry, if you will. Okay. And so there has to be some discretionary funds in there where you can get 30,000 people to mail a dollar somewhere every month or spend a dollar in a black business every month. Until that happens, you know, how do you facilitate that? You know, I'm a lonely radio show host and a blogger. Okay, I don't work at the Urban League. I don't have that infrastructure to say, okay, this is our focus. But those that don't have the intellectual properties to even put something like that together. So until the old leadership is flushed, like the current leadership at those type organizations, you know, which are cats that don't have any sense of process or the abilities to idea, create, and implement, we're going to be stuck in this, you and I, asking each other the same question every week. Why can't we just do it ourselves? So,
Good point, Mr. Allen.
I definitely agree with that, you know, but my question is how can we come over this, you know, because we know the problem. And about the people with money, like professional athletes and people like that, they are afraid of, you know, people who they work for. You know, they don't want to pay that higher price, you know, by advocating their people and whatnot. And everybody knows that. Maybe back in the day they used to, but not anymore. Not now. Nowadays it's something that doesn't happen anymore.
I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, it's a million-dollar question. If I had the answer and I could bottle it, I'd make $1 billion. But until that point where we all, the African community, the black community of America, until we all sit in the same room, there's too many silos right now. You know, people don't like me. People don't like my co-host. People don't like you. People don't like this guy over here. But
or this woman, or this young lady, yeah.
Or this young lady, you know, or that young lady, you know, until we you don't have to like anyone. I make money from people that I don't like every other day, okay? But I'm doing business, okay? It's another level, okay? They do that in the white community. They do it in the Native American community. They do it all over the world, except when it comes to us. If I have a tobacco shop and I've sold one more pack of cigarettes than you have, then I'm going to talk bad about your tobacco shop. I'm going to say that your cigarettes are stale. You need to come to my shop instead of, hey, you know, you're selling way more packs of cigarettes than I am. How are you doing it? What kind of promotions are you using? Can we partner, you know, or something like that? That doesn't happen. So I hope that answers your question, and that's like a really deep-seated question. Maybe we can, you know, try to figure something out in the near future or a year from now. But okay, like I said, that's a million-dollar question. Hey, thanks for your call.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Allen, let me do this because that's what On Point is all about. There's an interesting piece of history that maybe Mustafa and others may want to take time to go examine. It's interesting to hear the statement about why doesn't community do this, and so forth, understanding that we've been here in these kinds of discussions for probably the last 100 years. Let me give you an example of something, though, that ties into what a lot of the speakers, Mr. Chisholm, Lewis, et cetera. In 1987, Muammar Gaddafi, the leader of Libya, enjoying significant oil profits, royalties, and et cetera, actually put $1 billion on the table for distribution to the African-American community. This is all recorded in newspapers, both the Atlanta Constitution, Washington Post, Washington Times, Chicago Defender, Chicago Sun, etc. The United States government was able to intimidate local American black leadership in such a manner that that money was never distributed. I say again, $1 billion. And in fact, one of the organizations that initially indicated an interest in making application for that $1 billion was the National Urban League. I know from once I talked because I was both a delegate to the National Urban League Convention, but I was also the president of the Minneapolis Urban League, which was the chairman of the board. I was just taken back by the pressure and the arm twisting that both big corporate, something that Star Jones said, and there was a genesis for what Star Jones said on that program out of Tampa, Florida, that you played. I just had not said anything, waiting for the right series of questions. They're now starting to merge. Muammar Gaddafi placed $1 billion. The key person, and it goes back to something you just said to Mustafa just minutes ago about the player hating that goes on. The point man that Muammar Gaddafi had the utmost confidence in was the Honorable Louis Farrakhan. And it was unbelievable in 1987 to watch the catfighting, the infighting that went on in black America because it was Louis Farrakhan that had been chosen by Muammar Gaddafi to be the facilitator and conduit for the money. Hell of a history story there. Take a look at it sometimes to many of you that are listening in.
Okay. Wow, that is very interesting. Also, you know, Mr. Edwards, we have approximately, let me just go back here, about 22 minutes left, but we need to address Ms. Velma Corbell in the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, who have refused last week to actually sent a request for a meeting. And her response was that she had no intentions of meeting with me or anybody else that I was like-minded along with me. So we have issues with the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, and this is in regards to a couple things, ongoing case, and then also if they were ever go to file a case or investigate the mysterious double death, as I call it, of Mr. David Cornelius Smith, who to our international and domestic listeners was tased to death, pronounced dead on the scene on the sixth floor of the YMCA in downtown Minneapolis.
On the 9th of September, correct, thank you.
On the 9th of September, yes, and then mysteriously brought back to life via life support in HCMC.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel there is, and there was some articles in the Star and Tribune where his mother and father said he was handcuffed.
Yes.
While he was being tased. And mm-hmm. that right there should set in motion an automatic investigation. But,
correct.
Ms. Corbell and her staff, Michael Kip Brown, the investigative supervisor, has decided to kind of keep it clean down there. And
now, let me just cut in, Mr. Allen. I understand that actually the city attorney's office was required to indicate to you as the person that's facilitated so that our listeners, both domestic and international, understand we, Mr. Allen, myself, and a couple of the individuals made a formal request under color of law, as we said on last week's program, for the Civil Rights Department to initiate an investigation and examination of the death of David Cornelius Smith, as well as Quincy Smith, which, by the way, that case is still open.
Yeah.
People tend to forget that request was made to the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department back in December 2008 and they didn't do anything. The key piece that is of great concern is that Ms. Corvell and the Civil Rights Department are in violation of their own statute, or in this case, ordinance, and in violation of both state and federal law by their refusal to investigate a civil rights violation that has led to the death of an African-American in this city. And I guess, Mr. Allen, was not surprised in the curtness in which Ms. Corvell made sure it was conveyed to you and others that she had no intention of not only meeting, she doesn't have any intention of investigating the damn thing.
No, nothing at all. And this also, Mr. Edwards, includes the claim that I went down there to file also with against the Jordan Area Community Council, JACC, J-A-C-C. I got a letter from the city attorney's office, Susan L. Siegel, city attorney from the Office of the City Attorney, that says, thank you for your email dated September 27, 2010. Please accept the following as a full response by the Minneapolis Department of Civil. It says, the complaint you intend to file against the Jordan Area Community Council raises a conflict of interest concern. As you know, Michael Kip Brown, the Assistant Director of Civil Rights Complaint Investigation Unit, serves as the chairperson for JACC. Thus, a decision to proceed with your case would be improper. So that's what they're telling me. They're telling me that this guy can be the chairman of a community organization, his vice chair can write in his blog that his neighbors who are black, rats are knit better because rats know who their mothers and fathers are. Get away with
yes,
that.
Yes, and I've just been taken back over the last couple of weeks that, again, civil rights organizations and et cetera, maybe it will give a person such as Mustafa, who is new to the American cultural experience and political experience, a better understanding, and maybe it will help Lewis have a better understanding of why community has basically lost all sense of confidence in so-called leadership to do anything. I'm just amazed that this has happened. By the way, not leaving this point, Ms. Corvell, we choose this afternoon to also indicate to our listening audience that we would like to be able to join the secret committee that has been formed by the Minneapolis Public School District, Special District Number 1. It's a committee called Minority Women and Diverse Business Participation Oversight Committee. It
yes.
is fascinating. It's MWDBC. Oh, okay. This committee, which is comprised of Ms. Corvell, the director of the St. Paul Human Rights Department, Craig Taylor, Director, Office of Business, Community, Economic Development, University of Minnesota. Jordan Park, community representative. I know you're familiar with Jordan Park, whose representative will be designated and selected by the Office of Councilman Don Samuels. And Bishop Richard D. Howe, Jr. of Shiloh Missionary, which facility is right across the street from the district's headquarters. And the Pacific article or document that indicates the creation of this committee specifically cites what that committee's responsibility will be. Now, Mr. Allen, my understanding, this will be the second stealthed or clandestine committee that has been created. One has been created by Mortensen,
yes.
The other now by the district, and these two committees will run interference for and during the construction of the district's headquarters in which no legitimate or legal contracts will be awarded to African-Americans, and basically no African-Americans will be hired. I would like to ask that we join together and ask that we be allowed to be members of the committee. Wouldn't you like to be a member of the committee?
I would love to be a member of this committee. I would just love to find out what's going on with them and have some conversation and sit at the same table with these folks.
I repeat, this committee is in place, if you will. It is called the Minority Women and Diverse Business Participation Oversight Committee for the Minneapolis Public Schools Educational Service Center, of course, which is the big, beautiful building that will be built along the 1200 block on West Broadway. The initials, MWDB-POC. And I just have to tell you, Mr. Allen, I just would like to be a member.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
Maybe we can bring in people like Mr. Chisholm. Maybe we can ask Lewis King down at OIC to be a member. We can bring in people with knowledge about construction and diversity and et cetera. So
exactly.
I just wanted to take the opportunity on a program that we control, to indicate the existence of this committee and see if we can join. And I'd like to be able to report back next week the fact that we were rejected.
Yes, yes, we need to actually get in contact with them. You know, I actually do an appointment later in the week at the district headquarters where this is going to be one of the topics of discussion.
Oh, okay.
And because I want to find out, how do you apply? Do you need a master's or PhD, or, you know, what credentials I have to have? And you know, just get the skinny on it.
Okay. Now, I don't have the credentials. I'm just a, you know, South 40 African-American. But I do. I am a attendee and a graduate of the Minneapolis Public School System a long time ago, but I'm still there. I would like to submit those credentials as criteria for eligibility. Okay, so I'm just making my declaration now over the air, and also as a person who is chairman of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission on two separate occasions, member of the State Human Rights Commission, president of the Minneapolis Urban League, numerous other positions, and bring experience. And so I just like to be a part of the committee so that we can report out to our community what a wonderful job the school district is going to do in awarding contracts and hiring African Americans, right?
All right. You know, on the Wednesday of this week, Thursday of this week, I'm just looking it up here, the University of Minnesota had its Construction Expo at Kauffman Union,
okay.
And it was actually on Thursday, and I ran into Ms. Lynn Littlejohn from Mortenson Construction, and I posed a question to her. I says, who will own the district headquarters when it's built?
Mm-hmm.
And her eyes kind of crossed, and she said, the school board. I said, are you sure? And I said, and I also asked her when the next meeting was. The next, you know, she's having all these, like you say, clandestine meetings.
Mm-hmm.
One at the Urban League, the last dessert with Don, that's Fifth Ward City Councilman Don Samuels, was a presentation by Mortenson on the district headquarters.
Which
they did not tell anybody other than it was dessert with Don. There was no promotion around it. And some of this stuff is done strategically to keep those that are reporting to the community out of the mix. And they can keep people who they want in there reporting, i.e. Insight News, who, you know, if you're okay with getting your news a week late, I mean, that's good for you. But on the second hand, you know, we can put out news that matter in real time pretty quickly. But getting back to the point, this thing with Councilman Samuels at UROC was, you know, basically, you know, put out for the people just that they wanted at the table.
And by the way, there's been a lot of discussion, and you certainly should be advised, and again, this is for our both domestic and international audiences. The meeting also at UROC of the NERC, the NERC group, which in which I understand that the publisher of Insight has emerged as a developer. Apparently he's going to be a developer as well as he's an educator, having his trip that we talked about early on today's program to Chicago. But I was informed that there was a specific discussion that took place relevant to both yourself and myself, and that the meeting was actually closed, though it was a violation of the University of Minnesota's policy and state law, most importantly state law, because they did not want us to ask any questions. And I just think, you know, the public needs to know, and UROC needs to explain. And now you have people talking in terms of things that they have discovered as members of the revised NERC board, in which they have been stunned by certain questionable practices by the previous administration of NERC.
Yes, and that's absolutely right, because, you know, about a month ago, well, we started investigating. About 2 weeks, you know, I started publishing some information about NERC, starting with the disappearance of files and computers with information.
Correct.
And then I was fortunate enough to catch up with someone that was affiliated with NERC, which is the Northside Residents Redevelopment Council, another community nonprofit agency in North Minneapolis who wanted to be developers and failed in that aspect. And
miserably.
Yeah, and the gentleman who is an up-and-coming kind of political figure here, and I could I think he has a lot of integrity with me because he conversates with me on a regular basis, even though he says, I don't agree with everything you say, but it must be said. So with that said, I'm going to listen to him to an extent. He said, first of all, before they built UROC over there, the University of Minnesota's beautiful facility that I quite frequent regularly, there was supposed to be a community benefits agreement. The former director of NERC, Ms. Sherry Pugh, has yet to develop or distribute that particular community benefit agreement and the information inside of it. Secondly, he was on the committee to find a new space. What had happened was NERC was located in the Turning Point building on Golden Valley Road, and there were some circumstances that took place that they needed to flight immediately. And so this committee kind of got together, and it was Ms. Sherry Pugh and another gentleman, and Ms. Pugh, unannounced to the other board members and her partner on this, ended up moving into the basement of North Point.
Yes.
In North, on Penn and Plymouth, at a rate of about $25 a square foot. And I had enlightened this gentleman. I says, hey, you know, the office space downtown that we have in downtown Minneapolis, we pay about $14.75 a square foot. That's $14. And 75 cents. So how could the real estate in North Minneapolis on Plymouth and Penn be worth $25 per square foot?
You know? Absolutely. So, additional point, you know, the CBA, I have to indicate to you, Mr. Allen, I was a member of that committee.
Okay.
And there never was a CBA agreement. What happened was Ms. Pugh disbanded the committee because she and others maintained the wrong people had gotten on the committee. But I can name one specific individual that was a member of the committee, and I had discussions with him. Peter Hayden, the chief executive officer of Turning Point, was a member of the committee. Spike Moss was a member of the committee. There was a number of us. What happened was we kept pressing and pressing. In fact, again, I hate to talk in terms of the column that I write for the Spokesman Recorder, but I wrote about the benefits agreement and where it was back in 2007. But I have to indicate that the next time that you see the Pacific Party that you were just identifying, that you let them know that there is no benefits agreement. The deal was cut. Money, checks were passed to the chief administrator of NERC, and the benefits agreement just disappeared. Never happened.
Yeah, and that's what's happening with land over north, because if you drive down Plymouth Avenue, the precinct there, you have Penn, and before Penn, I think it's between Sheridan there. It's way before Sheridan. That's actually Irving, I think, over there. But there's a vacant lot on the north side of the street on Plymouth, one block before you get to the 4th Precinct Police Headquarters.
You're talking about the lot next to the Elks Rest, Elks Lodge.
No, actually on the other side of the high-rise there.
Oh, on the other side of the high-rise, yeah. Now, initially, that was where Estes Funeral Home was supposed to go when they thought they were going to be able to force Estes off the corner of Plymouth and Penn.
Exactly.
But Mr. Estes has not capitulated. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly where Estes was supposed to go. But what had happened was Ms. Pugh signed the deal with a developer and a contractor who was going out of business.
Yes, right.
And so what had happened is they got stuck without a payment, and I guess this developer ended up working the bank, and, you know, he actually, the NERC lost, the community lost, and developer won, but still there's nothing there.
And that was one of the, that was the genesis for when NERC sold the land that now is UROC, which was the shopping mall. That is the reason that the bank confiscated basically over $100,000 of the $140,000 that they paid for the site, because of obligations that NERC had to the bank.
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Exactly. Well, we have about 6 minutes remaining in the show, and I'd like to let people know that, do you have anything else to share? Would you like to go?
Yes, quickly on the sports scene, I assume that the Minnesota Twins are losing in New York, or have they started yet? But it looks like the sports picture is bright on one side, dark on the other. Excuse the pun. I'm not being a racist now. Randy Moss has returned to Viking land, and the white newspaper columnists and et cetera. By the way, the Minneapolis Star Tribune does not have a real black columnist, you know, as pertains to football. They do have one young man for baseball. But anyways, Randy Moss has returned, and we're now being told Hallelujah is to be sung by the choir, if you will, and this is the prelude to the Vikings' march to the Super Bowl. I don't agree with that. In fact, I hold to my prediction, 10-6. The Twins can't beat the Yankees under any circumstances, if you will. So the sports picture here, my friends, has been a little light and a little dark, if you will.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting, because I remember they wanted Randy Moss out of town back a while ago.
They hated Randy. Yeah. The only thing is, I think Randy's going to find out that, unfortunately, Brett Favre no longer has the juice in his arm, and those passes that he was getting from, that he being Randy Moss was getting from first Randall Cunningham and then later the great Dante Culpepper, who we had a chance to visit with last week in Nebraska, I don't think Brett's going to be able to get the ball to Randy. So I wish him the best, and, of course, clearly they do not want to play the black quarterback, Tavares Jackson. But, hey, they're going to have to do something because Ziggy Wolf, the owner of the Vikings, committed a lot of money, and he expected that they were going to be able to make it into the Super Bowl this year. I think it's going to be kind of tough. You know, like I said before, dark sports picture here in our beloved Twin Cities.
Yes, we'd like to thank everybody in the Twin Cities and international listening to On Point today. And if you're in Minneapolis, you can tune in to Minneapolis Television Network Channel 17 this Sunday at 5 p.m. to Black Focus with Mr. Ron Edwards, his weekly television show. He also has a column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder. Comes out every Wednesday. Look him up there and keep reading the Independent Business News Network. It's IBNNnews.com. We'll be back next week, same time, same
thing. Mr. Allen, if I could,
let's
be sure to thank our sponsors, our Canadian associates.
Yes, we'd like to thank Virtual Global Media Group, LLC in Toronto, Canada, for sponsoring On Point and continued support. And we also like to thank Backdoll Moving, who they didn't actually sponsor this show, but they co-sponsored the fifth congressional debate on this Tuesday on Minneapolis Television Network, and that was really nice of them to come through with some extra message. They sent out a lot of emails. They have a list of like 6,000, and they sure went to work in helping us in that.
Yes, they did, and also, once again, our appreciation to Pam Kobe, the executive director of MTN, who continues to put her job security, if you will, on the line by hosting these kinds of forums that are extremely important to getting the message out.
No, because isn't that
Yep, I agree 100%. Well, we're down to 2 minutes, and I just had something here that I was going to play here because, you know, when we asked the local community members to are the spokespersons, I should say, to do something, this is usually what we get. Hear them crickets? But with that said, we'd like to thank everybody for listening. You've been listening to On Point with Don Allen and Ron Evans on Black Talk Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Have a great day.
Take care.
Look, this isn't a Romulan labor camp. I don't have to answer your questions. I don't give a damn what you think.